Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis, and this week we're bringing back a full-hour interview I did last year with a dear friend and mentor, the one and only Dr. Jessica Harris. She is an absolute force of nature. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APN. Our guest today is the inimitable Dr. Jessica B. Harris, the great scholar of how African food changed the world's food. She's the author of High on the Hog, which was made into a smash hit Netflix docuseries. But I have to tell you, Dr. Harris is someone I often address as Auntie Jessica. She's a friend I've known for nearly 20 years, and the first time I interviewed her on this show, I told the story of how we met, and it's pretty long, so without going into all the details, it was pretty much like this. We met at a dinner. I was a nobody in the food world, was starstruck by her, I was nervous to talk to her, actually, and we were really chatting with other people. But at the end of the night, she turned to me and offered me some life advice, and while we were talking, I realized she'd actually overheard a conversation I had with someone else during that dinner. And I basically couldn't believe that A, she'd bother talking to me at all, but let alone really pay attention. And then she went on and said, "You have to always be listening, because you are not ensconced, just as I am not ensconced." Meaning that we weren't in the in crowd. And I couldn't believe she was saying this, because here's this person who'd already done groundbreaking work. And if there was anyone who's considered a serious player in the food world, I thought it was her, right? So how'd she not feel that way? Well, I've come to learn since that through most of her career, she saw firsthand how little the public at large cared about learning about African food or Afro-Caribbean food or African-American food. A couple of years ago, she was inducted into the James Beard Cookbook Hall of Fame and then won the James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. And those were actually her first two James Beard Awards. But last year, after her book High on the Hog inspired a Netflix show, and I hope you watched it, it's super great, she started getting recognized on the street. Strangers were coming up to her on her porch and asking for an autograph. And it's so awesome that more of the world is getting to know the work and the name of Jessica Harris. And I won't even spoil it by saying, what took everyone so long? Jessica, I'm so happy to talk with you.
I'm delighted to be talked with. I have a friend who nowadays, when she says, "So nice to see you," or when someone says that to her, she replies, "So much better to be seen than to be viewed." I'm delighted to be talked with.
That is a very strong sense of the self and where the self is at any moment, which actually, I don't know, kind of gets into our first part of our conversation. So I actually want to start by telling you that I had a meeting the other day with two people who are in the restaurant industry. And I happened to mention that we're having this conversation. I was interviewing for the show and they both gasped. Like straight up, they both like, "Oh my God, that's incredible. That's amazing." And you're laughing. Well, I shared their excitement because I've been a reader, a follower of yours for many years. You've blazed so many trails. But of course, I remember the first time we met, which was 15 some odd years ago. And my clearest memory of that night involved you basically telling me that you are not quite the food world celebrity who would make strangers gasp. So today I want to start way back, you know, food world celebrity or not, and start with how you became interested in writing and thinking about food at all, because you came up in literary and artistic circles. Your doctorate was in the French-speaking theater of Senegal. And early in your career, actually probably through much of your career, like studying food was not necessarily considered a high-minded thing. So how did you get into it?
Wow, that goes way back. I guess I backed into it. I have said probably before, if I haven't said it, I meant to. I occasionally think I'm living my mother's life.
Hmm.
My mother was actually a trained dietitian. She went to Pratt Institute in the 1930s and actually graduated with an Associate of Arts degree, which was a big deal back then. So I grew up with a mother who not only cooked, but knew how to cook, knew a lot of the food science behind it, cooked well, and who had dreamed, I didn't know this until very much later, of, you know, doing food demos and things of that sort, and apparently was quite good at it.
Really?
One of my most prized possessions, and I don't know if you've seen it, and it's on the wall in my kitchen, and I have no idea how it survived the maelstroms of my life, but it's there. And it is a letter that is actually addressed to my mother's teacher at Pratt. And it is a letter sort of saying, and I'm going to paraphrase it horribly, but we are very sorry. We thank you for your letter about Rhoda Jones, my mother's maiden name. And while we love the idea of her doing food demos and so on and so forth, we are sorry because the houses are not numbered according to Negro houses, and so we have no idea who the Negro tenants were. It was from the gas company, and it was about the time when people were going from wood-burning stoves inside to gas stoves inside. And so the gas company had folks, dietitians, who would go into the homes and demonstrate how to cook with gas. But the esteemed gas company didn't deem that a Negro girl, small N I might add, would be able to do that because they had no listing of which homes were the Negro homes. So I think I lived my mother's life in that sense. And one of my proudest moments was, I guess just before she died around Mother's Day 2000, and in Mother's Day, or for Mother's Day 1999, Sarah Moulton, and at that point in time I was on the Sarah Moulton Show as a kind of occasional guest food historian, Sarah Moulton did a mother-daughter thing, and so I got to take my mother on to do a food demo on television.
And on the Food Network
show. It was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary because it was like a kind of racehorse that had been let out of the barn. And she she complained bitterly every step of the way going in. I don't want to do this. I don't know why I got to do this. This isn't going to be blah, 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 blah. She went on and on and on. But she got there and it was just like she had, you know, sniffed the pasture. It was like, oh, wait. She did everything. She, who had given me the recipes, began to countermand them. No, I don't need that. And when she started talking about how the gluten in the biscuit dough grafted onto the God knows what, it was like, this is what she was supposed to do. And I guess I inherited it. Long answer, short question. Oh.
No, that's amazing. I never knew that. I never knew that about your mother. I never knew that you had this sense of, if not following in footsteps, but you had this sense of realizing a sort of destiny, I guess.
Yeah, hers. I don't know. I'm not sure what mine was, but I've managed to realize hers.
Okay, so let's get back to you and your story. You know, I had mentioned before, and I love this fact about you. You know, you, the doctor and Dr. Harris, you know, you attained by writing a dissertation on the French-speaking theater of Senegal. So not clearly related to food. How did you get from that place to where you started thinking about food in a serious way and writing about food?
Well, Senegal, ironically, was my first stop in, you know, what has been balkanized into sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, when we start to talk about Africa, it's a continent, and Sahara was certainly a very permeable veil. I think people forget that a lot. I had been, though, to Morocco any number of times, but the dissertation was the occasion for me to go to Senegal, Ghana, the Ivory Coast, and Benin, all for the first time, and I believe that was in 1972. And it's going to turn out to be another mama story because, as luck would have it, the girlfriend who was supposed to travel with me, you know, backed out at the last minute. And my mother said, oh, well, I can go. So my mother, who I used to refer to as my culinary secret weapon, went with me. And I think there was something about having kin travel with me that made things come into more finely etched reality. Because we tasted some of the same things the same way. Because we had, my taste had been formed by hers. So that when I tasted chicken yassa and got my light bulbs going off, and, you know, when I tasted chebujen and understood some things about it, and, you know, when I was first acquainted with sauce claire and all sorts of things, she was there to not only acknowledge, but to sort of gainsay, if you will. And so that's kind of where it started. I had been interested in food. I like to eat. I think most food people have culinary epiphanies. Certainly in my age and range, they were in one of two places. I suspect they may be in other places in the world now. But back then, you either had it in France or you had it in Italy. And somewhere along the line, it was like, oh my God, these people do food differently. These people think of food differently. These people respect food, handle food, work with food another kind of way.
Sure.
My epiphany came, I guess, in the 60s when I did a junior year in Paris. And I lived with a family for part of that year. And the father of the family, who was, you know, gruff and sort of formidable, every Sunday would cook. And he went to the Marché de Neuilly, which was the open-air market in Neuilly, which is the suburb immediately next to the 16th arrondissement where we lived in Paris. And many of his children didn't go with him. Now, you know, like, daddy's doing his Sunday thing. But I kind of loved it. So I would go with him and watch while he, you know, thumped melons and sniffed things and poked and prodded. And he would come back and he only made one dish. He made one dish, the same dish every Sunday, rather. And he made champignon à l'ail, which are mushrooms with garlic. Now, at home, I grew up in what I referred to as a garlic-free household. My father, who is a very big influence in my life in other matters, the matters that are more aesthetic, the matters that have to do with the way I entertain, the way I set a table, the way I even maybe plate food, didn't like garlic, didn't want it in the house, didn't like the smell of it cooking, didn't like anything to do with it. And so these champignon mushrooms weren't a big thing on our table either. These champignon à l'ail were just transformational and just kind of wonderfully aromatic and, you know, earthy and aromatic and stinky and all kinds of good things at the same time. So that was kind of my aha, if you will, moment. And, you know, so there's a little bit of each parent in that equation.
That's Jessica Harris, author of High on the Hog and many other books. We'll be back with more with her in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with the iconic Jessica Harris, the groundbreaking scholar of African-American food. We talked with her about how she got her start in food writing, and how it was influenced by her doctoral research in Africa and what she ate there. And just before the break, she told us about the food epiphany she experienced during her junior year abroad in Paris. Let's get back to the conversation. That was your junior year, you said, so you were still studying, you were engaged in this world of ideas. And how did you think, I want to start really working with this?
Well, I don't know that I did. I think one of the things that's interesting between my generation and perhaps your generation is, I don't know if it's my generation, but I was certainly a whole lot less intentional. I didn't say, oh, I want to, or oh, I'm going to, or anything like that. Sometimes things just happened. And what happened with me was, after I got out of college, after I started graduate school, and pretty much maybe after, while I was working, certainly I've worked for 50 years full time while all of this was happening. So that was the underground thrumming backbeat to it all. But
As a teacher,
I taught for 50 years at Queens College, which is part of the City University system in New York. Mm-hmm. But what happened was, with all of that, I started to work at Essence. I mean, I had a burgeoning journalistic career. I started out in theater, since that was my bent. I did theater reviews and theater criticism for the New York Amsterdam News, and have been told I was the first Black woman to vote for the Tonys. Mm. I did a lot of, you know, sort of feature writing, and I was the book review editor of Essence in the mid-70s. And then by the end of the 70s, I had sort of pinch-hit it for somebody and did an article that was sort of a travel article. And by the end of the 70s, or the late 70s, I was the assistant travel editor and then the travel editor of Essence. Mm-hmm. And as we were looking at editorial calendars, how are we going to vary this? How are we going to do this? How are we going to respond to various needs? I came up with, well, let's do food. Because I was eating. I had to eat wherever I went because, you know, you don't eat, you die.
Sometimes so it's that simple.
It is that simple. So I started to do every other month a column in which I went under the god-awful, you know, moniker of the Go Gourmet.
Actually, it had a ring at the time.
It did. But so I would travel. And because it was Essence, I was traveling pretty much what we now know is the African Atlantic world. Mm-hmm. And so I would be perhaps in Senegal or Benin or Côte d'Ivoire 1 month. And then 2 or 3 months later, I might be in Guadeloupe. And in the interim, I might be in Charleston, South Carolina, or somewhere like that. And, you know, my mouth started talking to me. Huh. And it started making connections and going like, that tastes an awful like something you had somewhere. And then I'd start to think, and where was the somewhere? Mm-hmm. And so it began to make kind of connections.
Yeah.
And then through those connections, well, stick a pin, as the British say, I by that time had started, you know, writing in earnest. After I finished my doctoral dissertation, which is now the 80s, had ended up with an agent, a literary agent, and that was because of all kinds of strange madness that had happened. I had written a Third World Women's Beauty book, and it got orphaned. And as a result of it being orphaned, somebody said, you know, girl, you need an agent, and suggested someone. So I ended up with an agent, Carol Abel, who just recently died. May she rest in peace. Mm. But she was my agent for decades. And she sort of said, so what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. What do I want to do? I have no idea. Maybe I'll do a cookbook. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how that popped into my head. Certainly not a trained chef by any stretch of the imagination. Had never really written recipe, because recipe was not a part of those columns.
Sure.
And said, well, yeah, I want to do a cookbook. And I think I want to do about food made with peppers and chilies from around the world. I had already had a sense of the international aspect of food. And so, I don't know, several weeks thereafter, this was the 80s. It was probably a lot easier to sell a first book. And I did have all of those columns backing me up, so people knew I could at least cobble together a decent English sentence. And she came back and said, well, we sold that book. And it's like, yikes. Okay.
And now you got to write it.
There you go. I guess I got to write it.
With champagne and, first, or do I get to work?
Get to work. Get to work. So, so I started writing, and something that was, I guess, the academic in me made me go not necessarily to recipe, but to history. So I read Marco Polo's journals. I read Columbus's journals. I realized that people talk about food all the time. You know, you don't just have to read food stuff to find out about food.
Right.
Columbus was hungry. You know, he wanted to know, what am I going to have for dinner? What's next? Marco Polo was curious. What is this? They're going to feed me what? So somewhere in all of those things, there's food. And so I started writing about that. I realized, or I became curious about botany. What are all of these plants? What are they called? What, why, you know, are they related? How are they related? So on and so forth. And so it came out as a very different kind of book. It was called Hot Stuff, A Cookbook in Praise of the Piquant.
Yeah.
And that was the first outing. Then after that, because it sold enough copies to make back what was its very meager advance. I think the advance was $4,000.
Wow.
Which wasn't bad. It was a fair amount of money back then, I say. And they said, well, we want a second book from you. It's like, well, okay. Well, So that was when I really started thinking about those connections. And that was when I came up with the idea of the second book, which was called Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, Africa's Gifts to New World Cooking. Well, you know, I now know that it was neither the iron pots nor the wooden spoons, but there were multiple unspoken and as yet still unheralded and in many cases unknown gifts that Africa gave to the cooking of not only this hemisphere, but the world.
Sure.
And that was the second book. And it sort of started me out on a journey that I guess I'm still on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the book that is the, you know, the real Jessica heads know about Hot Stuff. But I think the next layer of your fans, I think of Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons as being one of the first books, in generations to really explore the work that you're most known for, you know, the food of the African diaspora, from Africa through the Caribbean and to North and South America. And so as you were working on that book, how did you gather these recipes through this huge swath of the planet? And what were some of the meals you shared that you remember? How did you get in touch with people? How did people show you how to make these foods?
Well, a lot of things happen and had happened by then. I think as travel editor, I had had created a sort of a set of friends, and all of the meals from all of these varying different places were not necessarily eaten in situ. Some cases they were prepared by folks who had moved or who were no longer where they were supposed to be or where their grandparents were or things of that sort. So that in many cases, you know, they were, I can't say second generation, but removed. For example, in Senegal, my closest friends were some cases Senegalese, but in other cases from Benin. I went to Senegal a lot more frequently than I went to Benin, but I also experienced Beninois food in Senegal. So that things mm-hmm. happened like that in some cases. In other cases, I would be in situ. I made connections in Salvador de Bahia in Brazil, and connections that I still have with a candomblé house, the house of Casabranca, the Ingenio Velho. And there...
Can you tell us what that is?
Candomblé is the Yoruba religion as it was, actually they call it Candomblé Jeje Nago, so it's the Fon/Yoruba religion as it was inflected with Christianity in some cases not, on this side of the Atlantic. So it mm-hmm. is a new world arm of an old world religion, but one of the mm-hmm. things that happens in the religion is an awful lot of it revolves around food, whether food is offering, food as communal meal, or food as offering that then may become communal meal, and so on and so forth. So that was a whole nother valent of food that happened in my life that was very much a grounding in the food of the African diaspora in some kinds of ways. I traveled to the Caribbean an awful lot. In 1991, I came out with a book called, Sky Juice and Flying Fish. And it was dedicated to my Caribbean sisters, many of whom I'm still in touch with. So these were people who had me into their homes, who cooked for and with me. We shared, you know, recipe. We shared all kinds of stuff. I remember from one of them, she would always mince raw garlic into her vinaigrette. And I've never kind of had that before, but I do it myself now all the time. Another one was big on anchovy paste, and anchovy paste would turn up in strange things as kind of like the secret ingredient is anchovy paste. There were all kinds of folks and friends and ways that things happened that were kind of organic, really, not necessarily planned in any way. But then there were other things, because I continued to work as a journalist, and so I would, meet chefs. I can't think of his name, I'm going to forget, because that's what happens when you got a Rolodex. That's a bad term, because nobody knows what a Rolodex was. But when you have a kind of brain that's overstuffed, you know, you stick one more thing in and something flies out your ear and you don't remember it. But I remember that there was a wonderful chef in Pointe-à-Pitre, Guadeloupe, who had, I think it was called La Canne à Sucre, had a glorious restaurant, moved into a larger place and was actually trying to be one of the, if not the first Michelin-starred chef in the Caribbean. But just the way that he worked with his traditional food, what he did with acra de morue, which are sort of the incredibly light codfish fritters that they do in the French-speaking Caribbean, was a revelation just to see how that could work. Some of the homemade ice creams, if you've never had soursop ice cream, you haven't lived. It is just the most fresh soursop ice cream, freshly made. It's the most extraordinary thing in the world. Just discovering new vegetables and new fruits. I'll never forget, my mother's amazement to find out that the cashew nuts, you know, that we eat There yeah. is one nut. It grows like a little comma on the bottom of the cashew fruit, which is why they're so yeah. expensive. But the cashew fruit can also be eaten. It's slightly astringent, bitter, and they make it into a juice in parts of Brazil, caju. So, I mean, all of those things were kind of learned in place. I was recently reading about the Amazonian fish that's known as pirarucu. And pirarucu is this massive fish. The scales, each scale is about 1 or 2 inches long and maybe an inch across. And they use them as nail files in the Amazon.
Oh, wow.
But to have traveled through the journalism certainly greatly enriched, if that's the word, the recipes and the repertoire of recipes as well.
Yeah. And like you were saying before, having traveled these places and with an historian's mind, you're constantly tasting and connecting and tasting, connecting. You know, this thing I tasted in Brazil tastes so much like what I had in West Africa. And well, you start to help illuminate the reasons for that. I think you've written 11 cookbooks, if I have my count right. Soon to be 12.
Well, actually, it depends on whether or not you count High on the Hog as a cookbook.
Well, okay, so this is where I'm coming to. Most of those cookbooks are on the subject of the African diaspora. And you really talk a lot about that history. And you finally went and wrote a full history on African-American food. And that's High on the Hog. That book came out in 2011. What was the process of writing that book like?
Well,
in so many ways, closer to home. Was it harder or easier than writing cookbooks that came before it?
I guess at the same time, it was harder and easier. It came about because basically the head notes kept growing. The head note being the part in front of the recipe where you sort of define it and put it into some kind of context before you go into the ingredients. And the head notes in my books, if you kind of look at them, get longer and longer and longer, basically because I found that I was as, if not more, interested in the background and the history of things than in necessarily... Mm-hmm. the recipe as recipe. I don't cook with recipes. I cook, as the French would say, au pif, which would basically mean with my nose. I cook with my mouth, with my eyes, with my hands. I was doing an old praline recipe that I haven't done in years, just Monday. And I remembered looking at it as I was stirring the sugar and going, it's ready now. It was the look. It wasn't the temperature on the thermometer that did it. And I think that's how I cook, which is probably the way my grandmother might have cooked. And certainly I suspect the way my great-grandmothers would have cooked. But the idea is that we are kind of bound to recipe. The thing that was liberating about writing High on the Hog was I didn't have to write any recipes. telling the stories was the thing that happened in High on the Hog. And the stories were the things that were, for me, as if not more compelling.
We're talking to my dear friend Jessica Harris, author of High on the Hog. We'll be back with more with her after this break. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. Their products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We have the grand dame of African-American food writing with us today, the iconic Jessica B. Harris, telling us all about her life and food. And just before the break, we started talking about how she came to write her groundbreaking book on the history of African-American food, High on the Hog. Let's get back to it with her. Well, you know, I actually love that you're talking about High on the Hog this way because, you know, as a cookbook editor myself, I have great belief in the form of the cookbook as a way to tell bigger stories than just making what's delicious. Although, you know, there's great value and honor in sharing with people how to make something delicious. But I can't tell if you're elevating the cookbook by talking about High on the Hog as a cookbook, or if you are, you know, a little bit sort of shying from it being this tremendous work of history and of storytelling, which not only, you know, I certainly think so. I read it when you first published it, and I remember having many conversations with you about it at the time. And that book is 10 years old. And I think that book is now established and seen as a classic to the point where, of course, last year, High on the Hog became a Netflix docuseries. Smash hit. You starred in the first episode.
Well, I don't know if I starred. I appeared in the first episode.
You starred in the first episode. Right. People started recognizing you on the street.
Yeah, that was weird.
And well, we're going to get to that. And High on the Hog, the book, became a New York Times bestseller 10 years after it was published.
But here's to your point earlier. The New York Times now has bestseller lists in multiple categories, including cookbooks. And the thing that was...
Well, cookbooks are lumped in with miscellaneous and advice.
Oh, so excuse me.
We don't always
All
get...
Right. But the thing that was interesting for me about High on the Hog was it was on the bestseller list, albeit only for 1 week. But I'm happy for my week because I've been told I am now heretofore, until the day I go away from here, able to call myself a New York Times bestselling author. So that's a good thing.
You're absolutely right.
But it was in the nonfiction category. It wasn't in the category that cookbooks mainly come in. And I found that fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's not something that dawned on me until multiple weeks after the glow was wearing off and I looked again and started glowing all over again. But, you know, that's kind of telling in and of itself that maybe it isn't a cookbook. Maybe it is something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, but talk about that experience. Talk about this idea, how we started our conversation today, by me kind of reflecting on the fact that when I first met you, the specific words you said to me were, "I am not ensconced." And it was a warning to me. They were words of wisdom and advice. Never believe that you are ensconced. And, you know, today I can tell two people that I'm going to interview you and they gasp in excitement. So that, I don't know if you call it a rise or that, you know, that sort of transformation, your recognition, you know, you're now in the James Beard Hall of Fame, Cookbook Hall of Fame. You won the James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award. You know, these are recognitions that have been, long deserved, but coming to you pretty recently after many, many years of work and work that you said to me, wasn't always seen, valued, understood. So tell me your thoughts on that. Like, how does it feel to be walking down the street and have someone say to you, "Hey, I saw you on TV," and to feel that glow?
I'm not sure it's a glow. It's surreal. it's just absolutely surreal. I'm me. I haven't changed. Nothing has changed except the degree or the number, perhaps, of people who may know me or recognize me without knowing me. And it's of, in and of itself and in its own way, kind of wacko. There's something that you see. I was somewhere just last weekend and somebody, you know, people sort of look at you and they cock their heads and they're not quite sure. And it's like, I know you from somewhere. And then I, who am nearsighted and don't always see people and don't always recognize faces, am now going, oh my God, where do I know them from? Do I know them from, was it here? Was it there? And then finally the light bulb goes off for me and I sometimes will say, oh, have you seen High on the Hog? And then they will go, oh my God, that, you know, because they don't know me. They know, you know, the sort of floppy thing on the top of my head and my face, which they're only these days seeing half of because it's masked, but the floppy thing on the top of my head kind of gives me away, and the fact that it's gray and my voice and you know, and it's very, very strange. I mean, I think doubly strange, as I knew for 40 years Maya Angelou. And I remember her at one point saying that she could no longer go walk through an airport. Because she said people would walk up to her and thrust their babies into her arms kind of things, and, you know, go into all kinds of, you know, paroxysms of joy. I don't, thank God, have that. But the small corner that I do have is, it's fascinating. It's just astounding to me, because, you know, first of all, it's the power of the media, and particularly of Netflix. 192 countries in 30, I think, 4 languages. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. More than a little terrifying.
Yeah, I'm sure it's complicated, but I just have to say, as a, not really even as a friend, but as a fan and as a follower of yours, I'm deeply glad that more people have been introduced to you and the work that you've done to really teach all of us about this singular and absolutely vital story of food in the world. You know, without the food that you were talking about, without the food that you've seen, you've studied, you've documented, there would be no American food as we know it.
Well, it would be very different.
Yeah, yeah, certainly not as we know it. So let me ask you a personal question.
Oh no.
You spend most of the year in 3 places: Brooklyn, New Orleans, and Martha's Vineyard, all, you know, amazing places. And, you know, each of them is a sort of center of Black culture. Do you have particular food connections to each of them? Like, are there things you particularly love to eat or cook in each place?
I guess yes. Or there are certainly foods that I want to eat in each place. New York is probably the place where I'm the most omnivorous, just because I was born and raised in New York, so it's home, so I eat everything. You know, I don't just eat the foods that I write about. You know, Chinese food and Brazilian, well, I write about Brazilian food, but Thai food and Korean food, and I have the weirdest cravings for Indian food, and then get to the restaurant and only want butter chicken, which totally distresses the folks at the restaurant. It's like, try something else. It's like, nope. That's what I want. You know, so New York, if you will, is my omnivorous place in a way.
Okay.
New Orleans is almost like a look back, if you will. New Orleans is comfort food. And I do have to say about New Orleans and also about Martha's Vineyard, which I'll get to in a minute, that I am culinarily useless because I'm allergic to shellfish. And so much of the food that is, you know, emblematic of New Orleans is made with shellfish. But mm-hmm. I accommodate myself nicely and work my way around with such things as that wonderful, you know, mahogany rude gumbo that is, you know, duck and andouille sausage, or crackling, pork cracklings. It's that season, and I have already called a friend in New Orleans where I'm going to be going and said, okay, we have to make a crackling run. I mean, this is the same friend who was known to send me, you know, orders of cracklings. You know, they arrive in, you know, post office, you know, 2-day mailboxes that are dripping grease and
probably with the cardboard boxes becoming translucent.
Oh yeah, translucent boxes.
It's good to have good friends.
Oh, I do, who indulge me. I never get to New Orleans without having some fried chicken and stewed okra at Ducky Chase. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like home food. Mrs. Chase's chicken is, or was, I guess, probably the closest to my mother since my mother's been gone. You know, there are any number of dishes and places. Some of them, unfortunately, have gone because of, well, combination of COVID and Hurricane Ida and, you know, a lot of the awfulness that has beset the world in the past couple of years. I mean, mm-hmm. Upper Line, which was one of my favorite restaurants, is not coming back, at least not under Joanne Clevenger's guidance. And I don't know, without Joanne, I'm not sure. But
Upper Line can exist without her.
You know, there are so many memories and places and things to eat that, you know, that I just love. Pesh, a restaurant that, you know, specializes in fish. I mm-hmm. go, I have the fish sticks. They're sublime. You know, they're, you know, homemade fish sticks. How bad can that be? So there's all of that there. It's kind of looking back in a way at, you know, foods that are comfort foods of my past. Mm-hmm. Some of the southern foods, some of the foods that connect up with the foods of the African diaspora in many interesting ways. Mm-hmm. If New Orleans is the past, then I guess the vineyard may be the future in a funny kind of way. Although it is definitely a family home, it's somewhere that I eat absolute fresh. I go to the farmer's market. I don't drive, but I have, you know, friends who have been press ganged into taking me to the farmer's market, which is there twice weekly. And I, you know, salads, fresh salads with incredible greens. North Tabor Farm is my favorite salad green spot, but I'm also liking Bluebird Way and some other places. The vegetables, the idea of seasoning with salt that was literally panned, if you will, evaporated from the sea and then in some ways seasoned or inflected with other ingredients that are local is incredible. I have an amazing butcher at reliable market that is reliable, and the cheeses are amazing. So I guess there I eat more the way I might in France, or might have in France. I mean, I go to the market. I also do a lot of entertaining there. I'm not entertaining as much as I used to in New York. And my place in New Orleans is, for now, relatively small. But in on the Vineyard, I can have six people. I mean, this is all pre-COVID. Right now, I'm not entertaining a whole lot of folks, and certainly no more than four. But I could have eight people, and I would have, you know, specific meals. I would usually have a gumbo around the anniversary of Katrina. I would, once it became fall, do a big choucroute garni. I'd even bring up sometimes some sausages from New York and things of that sort, and, you know, shove them in the freezer until it got to be autumn. I do a traditional Bastille Day meal, where I do a leg of lamb that I do with herbe de Provence, but herbe de Provence that I augment with lavender from my garden. And then I use in the marinade for the lamb a blueberry salt that comes from a salt company owned by friends of mine on the island. And so it's a very different kind of eating.
Yeah. You are truly, I would say, a citizen of the world, but really the queen of the world.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jessica. It's always such a joy to talk to you.
This has been great fun. Thank you.
Jessica Harris's books include High on the Hog, her memoir, My Soul Looks Back, and the cookbook, The Welcome Table. For her recipe for Maya Angelou's 10-boy curry, go to splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. I hope you enjoyed our visit with Jessica. Thanks so much for joining us, and talk to you next week. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email. Weeknight Kitchen delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make dinner a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lutke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.